Okay, I'm Terry Thornton. I'm curator of education here at the Modern, and this tonight is part of our Tuesday evening lecture series that happens each fall and each spring, with 10 lectures in the fall, 10 in the spring. And I think some of you are maybe new to our series, and then there are those of you that are here because of the series, and you faithfully come and are enriched by whoever the speaker is. So with that in mind, I'll try to make my introduction, like I said, with that in mind. But this is a program I'm quite proud of. If you are new to the program, I encourage you to get online, see the schedule, see if there's anything else that might interest you throughout the rest of the series for the fall. It's been remarkable. Next week, we have Lawrence Wiener here. There's just, I'm sorry, no other way to describe him but to say that he is an art star. I mean, he is so important to where art is today. He is at the fore of conceptual art, and I encourage you all to come back and hear him next week. The title of his presentation is One Lump, Two Lumps, Three Lumps, Four. And that is, I hope some of you recognize that as having been in the cafe for a long time until we just recently did the renovations, and it was taken out for its own protection. And it has now been put up on the first floor in Gallery 5. So I invite you to revisit that and consider how, to my mind, text becomes sculpture. So I invite you to come back next week for Lawrence Wiener. I also want to use this occasion to let some of you who aren't aware of our Sundays with the Modern, which is a tour series that we have, trying to take advantage of the enormous talent we have in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. We have invited artists, architects, art scholars of all types and stripes to come and talk about the aspects of the building, the permanent collections, special exhibitions, and so forth. Every Sunday at 1 p.m., with the exception of holidays. So again, get online and check that schedule out. This coming Sunday, the artist Matthew Sonheimer will be here, and he will be here to talk about Vernon Fisher Kmart Conceptualism, which is a special exhibition on the second floor. And Matthew has some very unique and heartfelt insights that he's going to share with us. I've been visiting with him a little bit, and I'm just telling you, you don't want to miss it. Also, we're proud, very proud of our program where we have graduate students who have been selected. They apply and are selected to be a part of a program in which they choose works within the collection and then hone their skills in giving gallery tours of those works. And those happen every Tuesday during the run of Tuesday evenings and Saturdays. They're about 30 minutes long. They're very much worth your while. I encourage you to attend. On Tuesdays, we've conveniently scheduled them at 6:15, giving you plenty of time to see them and then make it for the lecture. On Saturdays, they begin at 1. And I said they run through the run of the Tuesday evenings. I apologize. They run through October 16th, so you don't have that many more to take advantage of. So encourage you to do that as well. We're so glad to have the cafe back. I hope that you will come early, spend some time in the galleries, which are open until 7 on Tuesday evenings, and the cafe, and take advantage of that as well. So as there's a lot to take advantage of. Tonight, we are fortunate to have artist and architect William Bruner here from Phoenix, Arizona, where he is the president of William Bruner and Partners Limited. Will is here in conjunction with the Fort Worth AIA Design Awards, which is a collaboration that has brought him here, brought us many interesting Tuesday evening lectures. I've always enjoyed that collaboration. This year, I've had the great privilege of working with Tom Maganello. I stumble on that name because I keep trying. We've been having some arguments about his pronunciation of his name, so I apologize. that's kind of an inside joke, but anyway. I've really had the privilege of working with Will to bring bring Will Bruner here to do this lecture and to be one of the jurors for the AIA competition. that is where my introduction stops, because I was in the midst of writing my introduction, and Will Bruder, who you cannot resist, you cannot tell this man no, said, if you know my name, you don't need anything more to introduce me. You need to come in and sit in on the awards presentation. And I have to say that I hope you don't regret it, because my introduction is lacking, but it was so worth my while. What an incredible presentation these three gentlemen gave us. And what I think a wonderful gift they've given the architecture community. So I'm just so sorry that all of you weren't here for that presentation. But what that presentation told me is that all of the things that have been written about William Bruder, which I would have quoted if I'd finished writing my introduction, and all of the things that you can know by looking at his work, could not have told me more than just seeing him in action in that presentation, how sincere, genuine, and gracious he and his co-jurors were in their comments and the time and evaluation they gave that work. What I do know about Will is what is, I think, always in print when you read anything about him, and it is that he has a kind of poetic pragmatism to his work. And I have to say that when Tom and I were discussing various ideas for this presentation, he talked about Will's work, and he talked about it in a very poetic way, and that is the way he described it. And I said, I want him to come and do this presentation. Will is a self-trained architect. His background, or his degree at least, was in sculpture, which I also find interesting. So I can't give you all of the awards he's received. Suffice to say that he's done something that brought him here tonight. And most of you in the audience know about his accomplishments. So I'm going to leave it at that. If you would, please join me in welcoming Will Bruder.
Thank you for the perfect introduction. So, a privilege to be in Fort Worth. I shared this with the earlier audience, but it was an expensive trip and a memorable one when I came here in 1974 as a young man. That was a few years ago. I was flying to Mexico for a summer break, and I flew through Dallas-Fort Worth, not realizing the distance at that point between Love Field and Fort Worth. At that point, rental cars didn't come quick and easy, so I took a cab, being a city guy. Okay, yeah, you've taken the cab, I can tell right there. So the cab picked me up at Love Field, and I had about 5 hours layover, maybe six, carefully calibrated, because I thought I could get back and forth and have lunch and enjoy the building. Well, I never got to lunch, and I did get back and forth because I got to the building. And every half hour, it seemed, I would come back out and watch my clock real closely and ask the cab driver, keep the meter running, you'll stay, you won't leave, because I knew I was in trouble if he left back then, and maybe today as well. So it was a $150 cab ride back and forth, worth every single penny. I've been back numerous times and always learned something when I come to your city, always learned something. I came when this building was finished with my two partners, and we cased it out and enjoyed it. And I had the privilege on this trip of two great surprises, one which was going finally to see the Bass Residence by Paul Rudolph, friend and mentor. Amazing, amazing. Oh, my God, you have two masterworks in your city. Oh, my gosh, you have more than that. And that's the other discovery with Kevin Kai, my co-juror, and the mind and the work behind Place Notes, the wonderful gift of the Charles Moore Foundation that he invented, Place Notes Fort Worth, which he sent my wife and I before we came here, one of my jurors, Trey Ann, the other juror over here, not to be overlooked. But I did not realize, and Larry was my friend, I thought I knew Halperin well, I did not know about Heritage Park. And we went there today, and we went past the chain link. And I'll probably close with the comment, but I'll tell you right now, save Heritage Park. It is a masterwork. Yes, applause. Okay. So, and my wife is here. She has a big hook, so I better get going. This is why I don't do titles at the front of my lectures normally, because the computer digital world never recognizes my Swiss font, and it always combobulates the letters, but this is called In Celebration of People and Place. Going back to those roots, yes, I was trained as a sculptor formally. At that point in Wisconsin, there was no formal school of architecture. That was founded at my leaving in 1970 with my graduation from UWM with a BFA in fine art sculpture, with focus in philosophy, full structures, urban planning, art and architectural history, 3 great semesters of Bauhaus basic design, proportion, scale, color theory, the things that bring me to this stage tonight, and a lot of experiences in making art. But it was with the focus to be an architect from the get-go. I worked full-time for a really fine studio, and the guy with, I apologize for my back to you up there, with the hammer in one hand and the nail apron, center stage, that's me at Paolo Solari's workshop in the summer of 1967. I both worked as a student and then as an apprentice at his Cosanti studio. And again, the whole idea of not only the ordinary becoming extraordinary, which we'll hear about, was founded with his unique invention of material on modest budget. But it was the same time in 1968 when I was there that the final edits were being done on the book Arcology, Architecture, Ecology, Architecture in the Image of Man, which was published before the first Earth Day. Paolo is 92 now and still, again, a reason that I exist. But I'm a man of contrasts, as you will soon see, and always listening and curious. So I went from that experience on the left to the experience of creating that model for a building that some of you might recognize. It's a Texas building. This is Gunnar Burkitt's, a student of Errol Saarinen's, Contemporary Art Museum in Houston, Texas, diagonally across from the Mies van der Rohe building. And again, I learned a great deal about process and design as a young man with Gunnar Burkitt's. I finished my apprenticeship when I went back to the desert because of the horizon, the million people that would be there, and what I sensed as the goals that I had in life. And I still exist and reside in Phoenix, which is my home. Oops, sorry. When I got my license, I passed the exam at the regular time of somebody with a traditional education. That was a good deed. I had 2 patios and this 1,000-square-foot cabin with a $10,000 budget, with a $1,000 fee, with a little extra money made with a nail apron working with the lawyer owner. He got some Tom Sawyer action on his friends. I got a little money for some of my friends at minimum wage, and we built this in 2 weeks up in the woods of Pine Top, Arizona. Again, my connection to the genius who made the Bass House, Paul Rudolph, he gave me my first award. He was the key juror on the Plywood Awards in the year of 1977. And this was given top honors by Paul Rudolph running that jury. $1,000, I doubled my fee. And it still exists up there. It was a good year, 77, when I won this award. Let's be a good year when this thing advances. Okay, here goes. Oh, there we are. And this little house that I built on 10 acres of desert north of the city became my home and studio refuge for almost a quarter century. Frightening to say. All of us learn. Some of us are slower learners. I was very slow on this issue. Very slow. Architects don't belong on the edge, they belong in the center. And that's the center of where communities are made. And fortunately, I woke up one day. So this was a 4-week endeavor in the summer of 1975. My wife of the time, 2 friends and myself, the main leads. In 4 weeks, we went from nothing to 845 square feet for $10,000, and we were floating on the desert, a transition from the urban fabric just down the road over my shoulder. Again, it was that simple statement that won a Record Home Award in 1977 as well. Later went on to do the integrated studio over there of concrete and steel, and there were rainbow moments over that studio. But the rainbow awakening that was possibly the most important was in 2000 when I suddenly realized that my staff of 9 people at that point was driving approximately 600 miles round trip to my paradise every day. Now that is a screwy diagram. How long did it take me to realize that? And the other thing that I did realize was that space doesn't change, but time does. And time had changed because in that 28 miles that I could do, barely meeting the speed limit when I first moved there in 75, had grown to an hour and a half to 2 hours, hour and 20 on a good day. Because in that distance of 28 miles was how many mini markets, how many stop and go lights, how many new entries to subdivisions, and how many more thousands or hundreds of thousands of people. You know, it was a bad diagram. So I woke up, I was reborn in many respects, and came to the city. And I have no regrets for that move. But I've always been known for invention and making. My hands, my thought, my, like respect for craftsmen and materials, invention, and again, this idea of the ordinary, extraordinary. So here's a client that comes to you for a house, a client building in a desert natural setting that always dreamed of a stone house but never managed to come up with a budget that would justify a stone house. So I reached inside myself, and it wasn't about finding a block that pretended to be a stone, which you can very easily get at the blockyard, but it was, what is the essence we're talking about here? We're talking about a rustic house in a desert environment, and i.e., you have the broken block house. These were salvaged blocks saved from a landfill, dropped in the driveway late with unskilled labor that became at the core of this residence in the desert, the scale and texture being as rough as the desert that surrounds it every way, literally the metaphor of a stone house. A house infilling in the suburban fabric of central Phoenix, a place of ranch burgers and evolution, the unbuilt site the client found inserted between the 60s and the 70s, and again, a sculpture of volume and form and texture. My work happens because of my clients, not in spite of my clients. It's about listening. The thing we do most importantly about architects is become good listeners. And again, I preach the fact that we do not preconceive because we cheat ourselves and we cheat our clients and we make it very difficult with preconception. Now, what is preconception? Preconception, in the heroic sense of our time, was the cocktail napkin sketch. We get the commission. We're all excited. As young people, maybe we're so excited about doing it, we go right to it. As mature architects talking over martinis or Manhattans or whatever the thing of the day with the invention of the cocktail napkin sketch was, you know, it happened. And what do? We don't listen to the client yet. We haven't thought about the context or the site. We haven't really thought about the historic place, if it's new to us, about what are the right materials, what are the right circumstances, what might the budget need. But we're all excited about laying a track down of what some form that we always dreamed of, and this client's going to get it. Okay? You have this client that tells you they're going to be your best client ever. And maybe you aren't smart enough to tell them they're gracefully, you tell them they're a liar because you know. Because they come to you with a story that we have no preconceptions. We want to get the most out of our dollar by investing in you, so we're not going to limit you. You're the artist. Let us go. Well, this isn't like the art that we see in this museum. Architecture is a strange art form that has service and purpose and function at its root. It has to be a balance of both pragmatism and poetry to make the art of architecture. And that person that has no preconception, that couple, if you will, or that corporation or that preacher of a church, how long will they not have preconception? Until they see the first sketch. They will have an opinion. So why don't we listen and form a conversation and get to the dialogue of what it's really about, and when they see it as an individual or even a community, when I'm working with libraries or a congregation, when I'm working with a synagogue. And when you listen and you engage them in the dialogue and you come with those first ideas founded on that sort of grounding, it's nothing more than delight to have an audience whispering, not being irreverent, but saying, see, that's my idea. He used it. Look at that. That's what it looks like. And they didn't know what it was going to look like, but they feel empowered that you represented that. And then you go on a journey together. And that's what I'm going to be showing you, are a few of my journeys through life. This simple house of complementary angles, wonderful clients setting up the urban fabric, simple moves, and the interiors. And again, it was all about that mountain you saw in the previous thing. From every point, from the conning tower at the top to the bedroom to whatever, you're always focused at that distant thing in an isolated courtyard environment celebrating the desert. The house has grown from the conditions of the outside in and the inside out. Great architecture is seamless. One more view of the mountain as we climb to the crow's nest at the top of this tin-clad house in suburbia. And houses have been an ongoing experiment, an ongoing relationship. There's always a couple there. There are great chances to experiment. There are great chances to meet places and people and do things. And this is called Skyark. It sits on a ridge in California. And again, it's interesting because the neighbor of this house also became part of my design team. And that was, having known him for a while, this was my first chance to work with Larry Halperin. So Larry Halperin was the landscape designer living right down to the right at the bottom of the hill. This is my method. It's head to heart to hand. Again, my pencil is as powerful as your computer, and more so. The computer doesn't bring ideas. My pencil doesn't bring ideas. My sequence of energy brings those ideas. And it's more important to learn how to use your wastebasket than it is your computer program that will be outdated by tomorrow. It's really at the essence of what's there as you think and you listen and you try to create this move. So this is the house looking east towards San Francisco Bay to Oakland and beyond. A house that again seamlessly moves from inside to out. Mount Tamalpais on the left. These simple ledges, a house that's been informed by the work of another Texan who has work in this community, Harwell Hamilton Harris, his wonderful Havens House in Berkeley, looking at this house across the bay. So I think you're starting to get a little sense about I'm interested in geometry and form and materials and light. And a house in the woods. A simple rectangular house, orthogonal, I can do that as well. A quietness about it, an ordinariness inspired by the ranch buildings of Wyoming. A simple long gable form. And being in an art museum, and yesterday I had the privilege of visiting Agnes Martin at the Bass residence, and this is my homage to Agnes. We have the careful wall of carefully modular cedar boards. I'd worked in the region for a while with the library and some other buildings, and not to be the fool in new territory, I realized that wherever there was a protrusion of trim, you would have a situation where you would catch snow and you would have weathering. And weathering and patina isn't something we all, you know, the big makeup industry in America, for men and women, okay? We don't like patina and wrinkles, right? So right now, if I can reach up to the screen and wipe my hand across it, that's how smooth that facade is, because none of those stainless steel frames that bracket those little square apertures, not windows, but apertures, protrude at all. We look at the gable vent. We look at the flashing at the top. We look at the precision. There are no notch boards. Everything was modulated, and there's ways you can make that happen and make it easy for your craftsmen. But then when we had all that anal retentive control of the situation, we chose, again, very calculated nails that would weather and stain the facade. Thus, the homage to Agnes. The art of the thing is in that weathering. The snow cleats on the roof, butterflies dancing into the sky. The welcome, the integration. The view out into the aspen. Again, apertures, not windows. And I believe we have a photographer in the audience there. I haven't met her yet, but she's sitting next to Tom. I'm this photographer. And it's again about how we see through the lens. It's about framing and formatting and looking at things that way. The inside, the outside. You might as well jump onto this. This is another wild moment, moving to the other end. This is a house on the high desert. The Fagan residence in the hills above Reno, Nevada. And again, it's this interesting program, an interesting challenge on the windswept edge and the sensuality of the curve. And again, materials and invention. And I had a chance to go back to my roots with that bronze hearth and the view on the right. And I did a wax model of that, and that was cast in a bronze foundry. You know, I know how to be modest and work with a budget very, very well. And I do know how to spend money as well. Again, it works both ways, with all respect. The ends justify means, and again, hopefully you always get your money's worth. Ooh, that was an interesting jump. A modest house, 1,400 square feet, the seam of two environments. And I think you know about that very well in Texas, because with all the rolling ravines and gullies and water conditions, you know, south of the 30, I mean, it's a very interesting thing to watch the mapping of this community based on the rivers and the water and the topography and the landscape. So here we have this anomaly, the swim hole here on Cave Creek, which is a dry wash, the Cahava Ranch swim hole that almost perpetually has water in it, and the cottonwoods and the trees going to the Sonoran Desert on the right. And this teeny little miner shack, this archaeological ruin that we discovered, a little retreat for a couple professionals from Phoenix, became this little seam between curving homage to Sarah, moving down through the desert to this stone ruin that was left just sort of sinking into the earth. It becomes a little sculpture, a little choreography of comfort You know, modern architecture is about comfort. Traditional architecture is about comfort. You know, you haven't done something wrong if your buildings are comfortable and they're well lived in. You know, that's a good thing. And there's the view from the swim hole. Modest perfection. And this was interesting because when we sort of pushed the budget, many people would have said, you know, let's keep the size, let's cut the quality. We cut the size and kept the quality. It was so refreshing. So refreshing. There are other choices. And I think as the world we've inherited, not just in the last couple of years, but with our new really sensibility about sustainability, this is something we should look at. Small is not bad. My wife and I are downsizing. We were going from 1,550 square feet to 1,141. Might not sound like a lot, but it is something that we believe in. And I do ask perverse things of people, okay? This is one of the sickest things that I ever have done in my life. And that was engaging these gentlemen over here. These are masons, okay? They are block and brick masons. They are not stone masons, okay? They are not carpenters, okay? They're not metal workers. These gentlemen are designed to lay modular masonry in perfectly flat, straight walls, as many blocks as they can in an hour to make their wage and move on to the next job. You know, random to them is not part of their cereal, okay? I thought as an architect that I was able to give them a specification, a narrative, drawings, a way of doing things. We talked with their superintendent, my job superintendent, myself, what we wanted. And what we wanted was the fact that I had a synagogue with a budget of $71 a square foot in the early 90s, where doing the building even was a challenge. And so I looked at the ordinary concrete block, as I often do. Because we are a block place. We aren't lucky like Texas is. God, I would love to come here and do a brick building. You guys got clay. You got brick. All the great brick buildings in Phoenix are generally made out of Texas brick. And they're schools and churches and expensive buildings, right? They ship in the brick because we had lousy clay out of the Salt River. The block became our heritage. So anyway, I've got this tight budget. I happen to be in a block yard, and I wander around places like that at will because I learn something. There's always something different happening at the block plant. And I saw these pallets right behind the mason. So that is really my mock-up, and that's what turned me on. So I look at the random... I got a pointer here. I look at the randomness of this whole thing here, and I'm saying, oh, my God, look what it can be. And that randomness just happened from taking the block up from the drying bench, putting on the pallet, driving it across the rough yard. It all rattles, and then you put it on the truck, and it rattles some more, and it comes off the truck, and it looks beautiful. You know, and I was there at high noon that time, and I saw the shadow coming down, and I said, this is my wall for the synagogue. This is cool. So we get back to the masons. We finally remembered that a string was their guide, and we made it a physical act rather than an intellectual act, because when they laid the first sample wall, and you can start to see the cascade here, they were making it a pattern. 1375, 1375, 28, 1375, and you could read it. The first long length, and I didn't rip it down. It was not that bad, but it wasn't where we were going. But there was no purpose in having an attitude and ripping it down. And we did get that you aim physically to your string. If you were within a half inch of the string, just plummet and keep moving and pick up the next block and do it again. So we lost a few masons on the job. They were a little bit confused, but while I was doing that, you're going to see in a second, I was also asking them to be a craftsman beyond craftsman. But the walls came out. You had this whole thing happening here. And isn't it interesting how that simple wall has this connectivity to a very important place to the culture I was working with? I think most of you know that this is the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem. And this is, again, connectivity. But along with asking them the crazy wall, I also asked them to lay a leaning curved wall that undulates, that tested all of their best abilities. They put it all together. A year later, this was one of my favorite awards that I've had the privilege of winning several times, numerous times. It's called the Gold Trowel. So you are sitting in a room with masons, all duded out. Some of the owners have tuxes on. Some of the cowboys have their big belts and hats and jeans on. They're masons. They're guys that make the buildings. And we're sitting at a table with a rabbi and an architect and the mason guy that owns the company that made this happen. And he's still a little bit confused why he's there. As the evening went on, he was a very proud puppy as he walked with the rabbi and the architect on the podium to get his gold trowel because he'd never won one before. But this empowered him to go beyond where he ever dreamed. Simple layout, simple materials. The lights were, the sky was just butterflies. These, some of this physical modeling. And again, look at all those people. I think I Let's see the UT Arlington crowd out there. Raise your hands. Some of you came. That's good. I did a little conversation yesterday without slides. And we talked about people and models. It's about scale. And there's the reality. It's about people. And I get excited about the muffin haystacks in South Park in Wyoming. And then I do a advertising agency on a difficult challenge little site that's all about this expression. And it's about logs, and it's about learning from place, and both the indigenous as well as the man-made. And the man-made there, again, an interloper in Wyoming, was an architect from Ohio. And I apologize, I don't know his name. I should, and I'm sure a lot of people don't know my name either, and that's fine. But that's Old Faithful Inn on the left, and that inspired the Riddell Advertising Agency on the right. And here's the simple definition. Pragmatism on the left. This is a work business environment for an executive, creative be that. He can make a big mess like all of us. But why can't it be poetry on the right? And what I mean by that is pragmatism is just the structures that there's too many of in Phoenix and there's too many of in Fort Worth and on the highways in between. They don't raise the hair on your neck. They don't become special. And there are background buildings I accept. But that doesn't give a background building excuse to be ugly and bad and a drawdown on the environment. It can be well-proportioned, well-scaled, the proper materials, and celebrate all itself, and it'll be cheaper, more efficient, and weather better. But pragmatism is there. On the other hand, we have our starchitects that are into form. Now, again, they are doing things that are just all about because they can. Some of them know the rhino command on a rhino program. They can twist, they can detort, they can twist and do all this stuff. But again, that extreme, architecture is not about that. It's not about being outrageous and radical. It's about the balance of poetry and pragmatism when it comes right here. I call it architecture. I have a very high time when the scale is out of balance. I always try to find that level. This is job number 317. Architecture is work. It is hard. People ask, have you done anything else? Well, I've been published a little bit. This was a studio of three people. This was in 1989. It was the largest bonded project in my community. It was 280,000 square feet. 26 people came to play. It was not a design competition. It was about building confidence and the ability to have trust in ideas and listening. And I went to that from a three-man position, and this became the first great collaboration in the larger sense of what that means in my life. And the first person I called when the RFQ came out was Ove Arup, the great international engineers. Because everything in my life that I have seen that really had the cred, whether it was the Stotts Gallery by Jim Sterling, whether it was the Sydney Opera House by Jorn Utzon, whether it was Hong Kong and Shanghai by Norman Foster, or Pompidou by Mr. Piano and Rogers. Adjacent to them were building systems engineers over. And I knew this had to be that kind of building reaching for that level. And I brought them to the table. And again, it was an interesting thing where I went to their mountain and talked to them. They came, as rumor had it, to me. And after going to a couple houses, a little library, and in the driveway of a car wash, Charlene Silverman, their partner that had the ability to check me out and say, we'll go, thumbs up, thumbs down, smiled at me. I said, what's the smile about? And basically she said, we'll go with you. And again, not being bashful, being an only child, I said, can I have exclusive? And for some reason they said yes. So with 28 players, I was the only one with Ove Arup on my team. And with 28 players, I was the only local team because I didn't go shopping for the star relationship. I went for the best in my local community, and DWL were my partners. And it was a wonderful journey with that team. We listened. We wrote a 650-page document of program. We had 28 citizen meetings, and the building became. It was built. It was built on budget. It was the box that Ralph Edwards, the library director, wanted because he built the Dallas Library in the number 2 cat seat, and it wasn't what he dreamed a library to be. This was his chance to make his statement as a mature librarian. So he got his functional box, and he got the icon beside. It was the box that was wrapped with the saddlebags of service with the Crystal Canyon in the center, total flexibility. The saddlebags are also the lateral bracing system for the building. And all this came to you for $98 a square foot in the day. $28 million, and we made the budget. Part of that was thinking about the backs of these gentlemen that are giving the texture here. Again, the dialogue with the block guy carried over into this idea about what could we afford for a finish on our panels. I think Mr. Ondo would appreciate this, but he has a different ethos of concrete, I know. This maybe Mr. Korb would get on this quicker than Mr. Ondo. But it was with this shunting of texturing the concrete, first screeding it, and letting the second consolidation in Screed not be a trowel, but the board, randomly going here, gave him basic verbal instructions. There's no drawings for that wall at all other than the idea, asking them to push down, and they're pulling up at that point, and with the wet cement, you got the rib. It's set up, and you see the evidence on the right. And here you have another part of it, is the skin is made of copper, but it was fabricated not in the fancy factory that I first called that had done the skins for the Hong Kong Shanghai Bank that I naively thought could be my source. They quoted me $100 a square foot. I respect people a lot, but that even deserved a return phone call. I had two football fields. In Texas, you know what football fields are, okay? I had two football fields of copper, okay? So I had to think and take myself back to the beginning of the dance. I took that slide on the left, and that is the grain elevators being erected behind the concrete towers or silos like you have here in Texas of the Hayden Flour Mill in Tempe, Arizona, taken in 1977, 12 years before I recalled the idea and am able to use it. I knew the curve was there with the industry. They were running sample sheets of copper in Nebraska, again, in a place that runs steel, and they say they'll do it. We made our copper skin for this building for a dollar more than drive-it stucco, a dollar more a square foot. At about $1,742, not $100, like the guys that made architecture. And there's our skin. It's weathered wonderfully. And this is the moment when it went from just being pragmatic to being poetic. When that diagram became a metaphorical mesa and not just a building. Because this wasn't just a branch library. This was something that had to have iconic value. This was a point of pride for our city. And here you can see how it mounts the freeway underneath that connects Florida to California at sunset. And it was a green building. In its day, this was done before LEED was an acronym. And in its day, had we had LEED, this would be what LEED Platinum would look like if we could have afforded on our budget to commission it, which is a big problem with LEED right now. It's too much about a false standard of USDA on your forehead and not enough really about values of what the environment's about. Working with OVERIP and their mastery, we have thermal mass walls because the concrete is uninsulated. It's part of the thermal swing of the building. We have the south facade, the most critical at our latitude with operable louvers. We have the north side with these fixed shade sails. And it is a building, and right now we have EB Silver in our lobby with a great investment and commitment of an owner. But again, we didn't have the funding to really push for the platinum, which we know we should have gotten. And it's about scale. It's about this sort of scaleless object at one level that you read in the landscape as the mountain edges around our valley. And yet, with the rolls of that corrugation, it's something you can put your hand and your body in and feel it. It's just really, and that's sort of like, you know, this is what architecture is about. It's about feeling. It's about the whole sensuality of it. And so you come into the Copper Mesa through the stainless steel canyon that plays with the sky, into the mystery of the Superstition Mountains to find the Lost Dutchman gold mine. You have the canopy reaching out, not for weather rain protection. We don't have ice storms and we don't have rain very often. But you come under the dappled shadows of this trellis into the compression of the tunnel, into the side looking for the mine, into the Crystal Canyon, and it blows you out up to the sky. And again, while I can say this building costs 98 bucks a foot, it did. There's parts that probably cost a lot of square footage. We got 7 acres, remember, that cost probably $60 a square foot. And this Crystal Canyon, probably in truth, if you costed it out, it was probably about $400 a square foot. But again, it's how you balance those realities. Fastest elevators in town, and a quiet sculptural stair in the manner of Noguchi, homage to Noguchi. I owe so many people respect and consideration for who I am. And again, sometimes you know you're making a gesture, and sometimes it happens subconsciously. But this was with great intention, the fast ride for the kids up to the top of the building. And again, inspired by LeBruce, 1861, one of the great, great modern buildings of our time, and a library. That's the first building I took my team to bond together, my team being Wendell Burnett, who some of you have met and heard of, with me for 11 years, and Carl Van Diemen, the president of DWL, my associate architect. The three of us and our wives went on a quick blitz of Europe to things we thought we should see. And what we looked at there was I had to stand in that library because that's where I wanted to go, and that's what inspired this. The great reading room of the Phoenix Central Library, that's what an acre looks like, corralled in four walls, and a ceiling and a roof that appears to be tethered down, and it's cable tensegrity developed by Mike Ischler of OVERIP, and it floats on light on the edges with its narrow skylights, and at every column I asked Michael to give me a structure that would allow for light to be the capital. And it's also a room about finding where you are in the universe. So like the solar observatory at Chichen Itza and other sacred sites, which generally are about sunrise more than noon, we have on the first day of summer, the summer solstice at solar noon, through each one of those translucent blue skylights, which you see in detail on the right, through that small polka dot aperture of clear light, and it's hard to photograph, but at the moment the roof is floating perfectly on pure light on both side slots. We've had 1,000 to 2,000 people for the first 16 years of its existence coming not to see wham bam, but something quiet, where when the building is on the floating light of that moment for about 30 seconds, there's a dagger of light at the tip of every candle column, and the cake is lit. And then you've moved into another place. And you're not talking about Phoenix, Arizona, or the desert Southwest. You're talking about the universe. It puts us in context, not with just ourselves, but our greater sense of self. And the sails. And these are two examples of my high-tech persuasions of architecture. There's some digital assistance that I've learned to grow with since the Nevada Museum of Art was done. But typically, I look at program. I make these little Ouija boards out of to scale squares. I understand the program. The colors talk about function. It's all tied to function, guys. And function empowers me. It doesn't limit me. So that's typical programming. Yes, there's some digital things, but I still cut the digital printout into pieces because I'm playing this and I can't do that on a screen, not just because I'm too old, but it's much more efficient and it's much more flexible because all you've got on the computer is the erase button. What I have with all these squares is the ability to think I have something, do a quick sketch over it, shove it off, and try again. There's no permanence about it. Now, that's a high-tech illustration on the right, though. That's high-tech skill in an architect studio at the max. This is, again, 1999, so it's a while ago. Technology has changed. Cardboard real model, technology of camera with film, okay? Picture, go to one-hour Photoshop, half hour away in Cave Creek or Carefree. Develop film in 1 hour, bring back, put on high-tech copy machine, enlarge, black and white, no color copier. Couldn't afford it, wasn't there yet. Blow it up, suddenly realize that, oh my gosh, this really sucks, it's really not there yet. So we get whiteout, typewriter whiteout works very nicely, better than white pencils. So you can see the whiteout happening, you can see the black pen going down, you can see some highlighters, and suddenly, the root of what was to become the architecture in Reno, the biggest little city in the world, the Nevada Museum of Art. Again, a building that has sculptural presence with total reverence for what's inside. A building that celebrates not only in contrast and contradiction through the neon and the driver of the town, this black mysterious object, but harkens to the black rock desert that surrounds the place and the mystique of the place to become the key sculpture in a small, intimate sculpture garden on the south side of the Truckee River. And again, I could lie to you and say, I carefully calibrated the day that I understood these rings would engage the building, and it is the work of a collaboration of me and Jim Terrell, but that's BS, okay, I'll be polite to that, BS. And I'll tell you the truth. Until we took down the scaffold, and I was there at the right time in the afternoon, and realized that the cheap glass they put in the Porsche developer building on the left concaved on me, and as the sun goes on the left, suddenly we've got these circles marching across the parking lot and climbing up the building. Like, is that cool? You know, sometimes if you're rigorous in your art, and I consider architecture my art, you're given really cool gifts just by being rigorous. Pretty neat. I look at sites differently after this gift I was given. So anyway, that's our building. And this is our inside, and it's a quiet chamber because art museums for me, and I think Mr. Ondo and Mr. Kahn would agree, it's about not really, and that's really interesting to say, it's about not remembering the architecture, but always remembering the art. The architecture is in support of the art, not in domination. And I might be really strange because I went to the Guggenheim Museum for probably 25 years before I did my first museum. And that was a little remodel, the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art. And when I had that, I went back to New York because I was working with Jamie Carpenter and some other things, and I went to the Guggenheim. I looked at the building for the very first time, I realized.
because my memories always of the Guggenheim was the first time I went there and was going up the ramp and looked across it, and Dan, that's Modigliani's great nude. It sure looks better over there than it did in Janssen. You know, it's really, really quite amazing, right? So I have this really belief in architecture and background and the circulation and the choreography of movement and light and filtered light and manipulating light are all part of the game. And small works and big works and flexibility. And God love the museums. You know, libraries and museums, if I could just do them all my life, oh my God. This is the auditorium because, you know, occasionally it's a pretty good audience. I'm happy for it. But occasionally in a small town like Reno, the lecture might not be that interesting, or the quintet or the movie that's being shown. And so you'll move into a smaller than full audience. So not only being a little bit playful here, but when you walk into this room, you think there's more people that are there because of all the change up of color and all the change up of textures. And it's always a full and fun house, no matter what the event is at the Nevada Museum of Art. And again, you can see how the sculpture of this space mimics and talks to the building. And on the roof, you come to understand, again, why the building is by looking at that horizon that separates you from Lake Tahoe. Bonded in the context and inspired. Now, I'm going to have to get moving here, and I'm picking up my steam, and we're about halfway there, and I'll shorten the time right now because my coach out there, I can see her already. Okay, so anyways, but one quick story. When I went, this was a little competition, and that's a longer story, and we aren't going there tonight. Some people that come to dinner will talk about it. But anyways, when I arrived in Reno for the first little conversation with the president of the board and the museum director, there was a place on the Truckee River called the Mapes Hotel. Mapes Hotel was one of the first casinos of the new age of power on the Truckee River, and on the top of it was this glass room. I thought, that's really peculiar, right? Because we know what casinos are now. They're these sensory deprivation chambers that you put you into that you don't know where you are, and you're just in lights out, right? Well, that was sort of the day maybe of James Bond or Fantasy of the West, right? Because the casino was the glass form on the top of this tower. Well, the Mapes Hotel was aged. They couldn't salvage it. They tore it down. That glass room was a public room in this community with all its attitude and reputation. It was taken away. So as we developed, even though it wasn't part of the program, we decided to return the Mapes room to open sky condition and make both a wedding space, a party space, and space for art. And so this is a response to the context of that very contemporary built reality.
And I've had the privilege now of working with a bunch of developers, and I really like doing condos and inexpensive condos. This was for a young woman from Canada. It's called The Veil. And that's what's called pungently optimistic green on the walls. And it's this is what the density of Manhattan looks like. So any of you, not Manhattan, excuse me, of Brooklyn and Queens. So any of you that get the crap where you work, excuse me, crap is not, I guess, it's okay word. Get the crap from BR and City Fathers that density is bad and you like this rural stuff. We're living in a different age, folks. It's about community coming together. It's about abandoning the car. It's about supporting new streetcars and light rail. It's about living as people among each other and becoming a community. And this is how scary the density of Brooklyn looks. And if we did this at every site of a light rail stop in Phoenix for a one-mile circle, we would increase over 1 million people of population at 15 stops with very little impact on the infrastructure and not impacting the rise from the desert we've destroyed. And there's a courtyard in between. And this is a little just off center, that red rectangle is supposed to be slipped up a little bit. You can see the empty lot. This is in downtown Scottsdale. And this is a little fiveplex. And this is what the developer showed me when I went there to see if they could get the efficiency of more than 3 units to make it perform. They easily got 5. But more importantly, when I stood on the site, as I looked at it, beyond the palm tree and the edge condition, I turned it over my shoulder to the northwest. That's Camelback Mountain. That's the trophy mountain of Phoenix. That's where all the rich people live. You know, and we're in downtown urban Scottsdale, and that's what that looks like. And this became the Loma 5, $120 a square foot, completed in 2004. And again, that sawtooth is all about everyone having the privilege of the view to the mountain. Again, it's about 80% sheltering shade of the perforated metal. It's very green, it's very energy efficient. It went through a green building program in Scottsdale. Again, money or need of brandy was not needed for LEED.
It has a living fence. It has a non-heat-seeking auto court. And again, it has this cowboy building, so you have the preciousness of the zinc facade and the sides of corrugated rusty metal, just like a cowboy town. So this is Will Does the West. And this is the living that's in. This was designed as a spec building. I did not plan for this to be my dream house. A friend whose husband had passed away bought the first unit. It turned out her and her husband always wanted me to do a house for them, but didn't know quite how to ask. Because, you know, sometimes I think you're too important, and gee, you wouldn't deal with a little problem. But that's another story. I got lucky. So that woman bought unit number one. And in the course of 2 years of the final punch list, as we were talking about getting her moved into her home, we had a wonderful dinner. And I live at La Loma. And Louise is my wife. And I am a very lucky man. And it's pretty interesting because it wasn't designed except for the anonymous client. And I've gotten so much joy in the 6 years we've lived there. And a lot has to do with Louise, but it's pretty good architecture, too. And I've got about 200 photographs of that window. So anyways, enough words for just a quick second. So let's just, because words aren't everything. It's really not just pictures. So architecture has the ability to make community. It's not so much about the buildings we make, but the spaces in between. And if I have any regret in life, it's that I have not been able to challenge the idea of the density in the environment that I chose to practice. But that environment has been very good to me. My studio in the city, after leaving the desert after 25 years, was right where the Asterisk is. And this is a little competition we played for a new W hotel over in the athletic zone of the downtown. And this is the interactive process at our studio. It's about trying ideas and making models and having conversations and rolling up your sleeves and about partners and about friends and about staff and just about working hard and, you know, trying things out. This was a competition. And we're a strange art form that play these things, but I'm not a strange instructor. Trey that just trumped me in space today, but we won't talk about that. He doesn't want to talk about it anymore, but we go to all pains for the passion of what we do. But we don't worry about our accountants. We don't worry about our bottom line. Yeah, we really want to make a difference. So this is a tower, a simple double-loaded precast tower with a stretched stainless steel scrim to shade it, with eight townhouses on the roof, head houses on the roof, not just one, and an arrangement of a sloping Italian hill town. Borrowing Corbusier's skip-loaded floor so that in the condos that were part of this tower, you could see the sunrise in your unit and see the sunset and save on elevator stops all the way up. It would have been fun. It would have been very special. You guys in Texas do good towers. I'd love to come and do you a tower. This is 211, another quick dream about mixed use in the city, all the way from the market we need downtown in Phoenix to mix small townhouses and condos, the interesting garden living workspaces, to living in the sky. That's at the definition of our 300-foot block, simple slab. That is at the height of John Hancock in Boston. That would have been that defining building, because high-rises, as you all know, do define our skylines, good, bad, or otherwise. This was a competition we won in Dubai, the iconic tower competition, $1.5 billion for three towers over the Emirates Highway. But it wasn't about, isn't that a joke from what you know about Dubai, that a tower can be iconic? Yeah, I mean, so this wanted to be zero carbon. This wanted to be a social change where we have this whole marketplace and garden here and shade with the community and this shopping, this souk here, this the whole thing. And so I went and discovered Dubai. And I said goodbye to Dubai. It just wasn't there. And I thought I'd take a lot of crap from a lot of friends. And they were all very pleased that I made that decision because they knew me and they knew my values and they didn't think it was there. And I wasn't trying to be prophetic, but we all know where Dubai is right now. And I probably made a good choice. And there's an interesting ending to that story as well. Again, collaboration. This is the Lord's table, literally. This is Norman Foster's big desk at on the Thames. And Andy Bowe is, where is Andy Bowe? Andy Bowe is here somewhere. This is Stefan Banish. This is Christy Tonight, the great landscape architect. I think this is the principal that did the opera house over in there. Norman wasn't here at the table. That's me. And we formed a collaboration to go after the ASU Arts and Business Gateway. It was a competition, a developer competition. We put the team together. It was Clouds and Canyons, and that's the winning scheme that you see there on the right. And so this is at the scale of Paris with a rooftop environment that would have changed how life existed in Phoenix. This is what it looks like with the Chili's in a parking lot. This is what it looks like at the portal, not only from town to gown, but gown to town. Somehow, in the velocity of our time, we'll never see the light of day. And this is our rooftop fantasy. But what a great learning experience, and what a great rush. 2 years later, the developer was given an email to a BlackBerry from the president of the university. Not even a call, not even a letter. The former president, the first female president of the student body of ASU. Life is interesting, isn't it? This is a library in a faraway town on San Francisco Bay of Hercules, California, in collaboration with HGA Architects. And it's this meeting of the Spanish heritage, not unlike what you have in Texas of the missions in California. So this is the Western culture of the Spanish mission meeting the Eastern culture, because this was a very diverse community. They loved each other. We had Samoans, we had a black mayor, we had the Latino vice mayor, we had some Anglo guys and gals mixed in, and they really enjoyed each other. We had a whole Eastern culture, not only Samoan, but Korean and Japanese and Chinese. And so this building presents the street aspect here. It's Hercules, so we have the fires of the temple in Greece burning in the corner there of the reading room. We have Willie, an important player. This is another one of my work stories. This is a recent one. That's Willie. I'm Will. I'm up on the scaffold at the high corner laying the first sample of 100 square feet of tile. We had the idea again, as you've seen my ideas, don't come with little instructions or drawings because you can't afford to do that. There's basic rules here where you have two different widths, five different colors. You can't notch any brick, Willie. Okay, you got to accomplish that because I don't care how wide your vertical joints are. And you got to figure out how to run them to the opening so you never notch a tile. So we worked for about 3 hours up on the thing, and Willie, this is a new game for him. And Willie personally put the tile on the building. Four people supported him. He put every tile on the friggin' building. I felt good after the first morning. A week later, the superintendent showed me the next few hundred feet that he had done. I knew Willie was fine. I came back. I was able to say thank you to him. But that's how you make architecture. You make architecture with people. Make architecture with craftsmen that you know how to listen to and ask if you can do something better or different, and sometimes you get better solutions, and sometimes they work hard, even if it's not totally logical, do what you want. And then when you're done, you shake their hand and you say thank you. And they're all shocked because most architects don't say thank you. They just move on. Or else they do it my way or the highway. And here's that Eastern garden inside that clay form. And again, the tile I laid vertical because I didn't want you to mistake it for a brick building in Earthquake 4. That would be totally erroneous. And it is just a plate. Even if Mr. Boda's building down there at SF MoMA looks like a brick building, those are brick tiles on a concrete building to survive the next San Francisco earthquake. But this is that garden, the CMG, the landscape architects, and that's the orchid tree and the wonderful moss garden. And the storytelling. A homage, one more homage. This is Bernard Maybeck. Some of the architects in the audience might know who that is. The great grand character, the progenitor, the equal in every way, and inspiration for Charles Moore. But I know his work intimately, even though I never met him for real. And this plywood, cheap plywood, blue stained tower with the operable skylight diffuser up there operated by a fishing rod reel is the story poem for the kids. I do corporate, and again, I've worked for the Hinkle Corporation, Dial Hinkle, into skincare products and house care products. Tradition and architecture, the left, the Larkin Building by Frank Lloyd Wright, a mail order soap house in Buffalo. On the right, we have Johnson's Wax into waxes and floors.
And in the center, we have the Van Nel building in Rotterdam, one of the great modernist buildings, because my client is from Europe. Again, one of those first studies, talking about site and context and the parking garage. This is what 350,000 people and 900 cars look like in conception on a very long site at the projection of a future urban place, that one of these new city things that never happened because the bust happened, but our building did. It's a building to be seen from 6.5 seconds at speed on the Highway 101 freeway in front of it. And that's what a building looks like at 6.5 seconds. It doesn't look like predictable industrial park stuff where there's boring grids of columns and windows and mullions and all this stuff. It looks like a blur of a cloud against the horizon that talks to the clouds of the summer monsoons. Coming up the main drag of Scottsdale Road, going to the desert, and looking at it engaged in that desert with the fritted glass forms and the north side adjacent to the 7.5 minute walk to the future urban fabric of this little new town that's growing to the north from it. The parking garage, again, homage, Annie Albers and her fabric textures, graphics, Herbert Beyer. Daylight brought three levels down to the bottom of 900 cars. This is where we should be putting cars in our cities, ladies and gentlemen. Fort Worth suffers from the same thing as every city in America. Too damn many land bank parking lots waiting for some person that can make more money on a parking lot than good urban space. It's a travesty. That's always bottom line. But let's make our cities dense and more compact. And this is parking at the urban edge. This is the porte cochere for the drop-off. This is a model with people of our vessel of light. And this is the reality of the vessel of the light with one of the first uses in America of ETFE technology and these pillow skylights. That's similar to the swim hall at the Olympics in Beijing. And this is the catalyst mixing bowl that Brad Casper, is the director and CEO, in a six-hour conversation, talked to me about the building becoming. Places to share ideas and meet and gather and put a corporation into the optimum of research as well as operation. On the way to the cafe, in the cafe, place to again meet, eat, have fundraisers, have parties, have celebrations. One of the corner meeting spaces happening to be the CEO's office, and there you can see the play of the fritted glass looking across the desert. The boardroom, another waiting area. And a view through the fritted glass to an 1.5-acre roof garden on the third level that extends the desert beyond the environment of the corporate world. Again, reaching to things that haven't been. Context. Phoenix is just like Fort Worth. We have Blimbies, we have Taco Bells, we have Chevron stations with car washes. Behind it, we have an overlooked piece of property that a library can afford with no street frontage. So what do you do? So this is the public realm of public architecture. Oops. And I knew it would be a box because the budget was very tight. And everybody had been the last kid on the bond train. And so I thought of cowboy buildings, and I brought these two photos to my interview to get the job. Because I was talking about how we have to really be responsible thinking about that old architecture. And so what we have is a post office, or this is a post office. One's a post office, post office, and a city hall. And that's your false front cowboy building. Voila! A false front cowboy building. Set back from the main right of way. That is 48 foot tall, where the A is on the top of the warping screen. Those letters are 28 feet tall. You can see it from 1.5 miles away when you come off the freeway. You can see it from 5,000 feet, I've learned, landing in Phoenix when you're coming back from Portland. It's reflective, freeway, 3M product, ground lit from below. It's just the stuff you see on all the green freeway signs. So it's very low tech technology. I thought this would be the first thing we'd lose in value engineering. It was only $130,000 against a $7 million budget, and nobody would give it up. And again, inspired by the movie screens of our recent history. So I look back, way back, and I look back fairly recently. And there's my movie screen. Come behind it, and it's just a false front for this masonry box behind, another gold trowel, if you will. This is the entry. This is the branch library, what a branch library at 28,000 square feet looks like with one service point, ladies and gentlemen. No children's librarian, no reference librarian.
One person working that desk controlling a 28,000 square foot. That's the world you give us. We've given ourselves. Talk to your politicians. To be responsible and have a community, you have to pay taxes. You don't run from taxes. We still have a chance. Everything isn't perfect. I still have hope. We know there's issues. But let's be responsible to our community. It's a part of investing in the greater good of the community. It's not about socialism. It's about civilization. You're architects. You should know that. Oh, that's public art. That's Buster Kendall doing this wonderful public art piece, marking our one-person service desk with this wonderful cloud. And those are just trusses. That's basically just your basic, you know, Home Depot architecture, a little bit of flair. Those are exposed wood trusses and exposed insulation and ducts, because it's all about that. But then we got a story tower. I got this thing now about story towers. So you'll probably see more out of Wilbur, and they'll never look quite the same, but this is sort of a homage to Corbeau. And this is inside the story tower at the Gavi Library. And this is what it looks like when you're 2 feet tall. Story, and you're looking up. And what are you thinking when you hear that first rendition of, one of those parables? And this is through the scrim at another time in that transitional space between the concrete box and the warping screen. And today, I have an 1,100 square foot cabin to do. 1,100, not 1,000, square foot cabin, 1,100. That's two zeros, not three. On a lakefront site on Lake Ponderay in Idaho, for a client that bought a lot with 1 foot of lake frontage at this point. Okay, it's that bridge, okay? And Peter Otis from Chicago has a dream. And I'm in, and he saw one of my big houses that had no right, one of my big houses where I spent lots of money. He saw that and wrote me this very beautiful little letter with a picture on the left and said, "Will you do my house?" And I met him over coffee in Chicago because I happened to be there by where it worked. And we said, "This could be fun." And I'm taking the challenge. And it's going to be really cool. And the whole thing, he's got 1,100 feet. And this guy, his key program is a bachelor, 45 years old, never married, I'm sure. He's always wanted a pool table. Okay? Any of you in this room that play pool knows by the time you take 5 foot for the cue, and you got a regulation table, I've never had a rich doctor that had enough guts in the end to pay for his dream of a pool game, and here's Peter Opus, and it was 1,100 feet, he's devoting 480 square feet to the pool table. Now this is, eccentricity high, I can relate. And this is an interesting ending, next chapter, I shouldn't say ending, to the Dubai story, because I came back from saying goodbye to Dubai, and October 1st of 2006, and on October, I think it was 16th, on a Saturday morning, into my studio on a Saturday morning, I received a call from HLA Architects, Henning Larsen in Copenhagen, that were the master plan architects for King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia's financial district, a total city being built in Riyadh. And he wanted to bring his client from RIC, Waleed, representing the king, to look at various sites, and we were on his map. So they showed up in Phoenix, and they seemed to be impressed, and I showed them Dubai, and I explained with all reverence, because I didn't want to offend the Arab community or anybody else, why I made the choice. And Wally said, "I bet you'll hear from us." And that's a cheap line, right? That's like a girl, he'll hear from me. Okay? Wait till I call. Okay? And Wally did call 3 years later. And right now, we are finishing Block 208 in King Abdullah's financial district in Riyadh. Our neighbor on one side is Norman Foster and Stefan Babish and Fox and Fall, HLA. And we're doing 650,000 square feet with parking underneath where it belongs. We have a wadi. We have a city that's very challenged about bringing the future to the Arab world in a very interesting way. And last week, we got 3 dedicated car parks, because when I met with Waleed and our team and their team last year in October when this all started, 3 years for that call to be when it happened, and I said, I was looking at the whole thing and just chit-chatting. I said, "Well, let's go do the parking garage." I saw these 3 big parking garages. They had public parks on the road, and that was pretty exciting. And he said, "You'd be interested in a parking garage?" I said, "You betcha." So right now we're working on 3 parking garages that we got a couple weeks ago. And they will have public parks on the road, and they will be the entry for anybody that drives into the King's City as a visitor to see it. So it's the front door. So we're going to be the three front doors of the King City. Pretty cool. We now have our Aetna link for five attractors. So knock on wood, we'll see what happens. Museum of the built environment, the library, which we think we're suited for, the spa portals. And we're sort of headed to class right now over all the 30 other architects because we got the first A team out there. And I have a staff right now of about 24 people. And we work really hard and we have that good fortune that we aren't forgetting what brought us to the dance. The ordinary becomes extraordinary. And we're doing more planning. And this is CBD 101. And again, football stadium. That's the Cardinal Stadium in the right there, the University of Phoenix Stadium in Glendale, Arizona. The football team that was tired of playing in a college stadium at ASU sold the naming rights to the University of Phoenix. And we all know what the University of Phoenix is out there in the ether. But this is a green city we're working on with them. And it's totally photovoltaic, and it is about the future. And it is about slow-growing food for agriculture and mixed work use and a new pattern of what the city can become. So we're pretty lucky guys and gals. And that's pretty interesting. Wow, that was cool. Let's go back there. Okay, that's very nice. Okay, whoops. That's me. Those are my three partners. We're now a partnership. And that's Ben, the tall guy next to Noguchi there. That's Rob in the background, and that's Richard in the foreground. And we are a partnership, and we are truly collaborating, and we're trying to build a good place to work, and we're trying to build a place of respect and respectability. We're trying to have fun. We're trying to make a living. We're trying to make architecture. And that's what it's all about, is making not architecture, but places for people, cities, community. And thank you very much for having me be part of your community. Thank you.